Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host, and our guest today is TJ Kennedy, Acting General Manager for the First Responder Network Authority, FirstNet, within the U.S. Department of Commerce. So, TJ, would you tell us more about your plans to ensure the FirstNet system is built with necessary physical and technical redundancies and resiliency? And what are you doing to hardening the system? How do you envision hardening this system?
Hardening's a very interesting component for FirstNet. One of the efforts that has been brought forward by public safety is what happens during a lot of our natural weather or big events that take down a lot of the terrestrial systems that exist today. If we look back at Hurricane Sandy or Hurricane Katrina and how that affected some of the on the ground communications because of the lack of infrastructure, the lack of generators and battery backup at a lot of these communication facilities, it's something we're trying to build in from day one for public safety. So we're looking at power as one of the main issues that really needs to have redundancy. Power is typically the first thing that is lost at a lot of these communication sites. The site may actually stay up, but either shoreline power or even generator or battery backup power is not there long enough for these bigger incidents. If we look at a Hurricane Sandy, some sites stayed online until the backup power went out. But after that, they didn't have the ability to continue to operate. And so that's a key part of resiliency. As far as physical hardening, a lot of that comes with geography. We know where hurricanes typically occur. We know where certain sites or cities are below sea level in some cases. You know, and when we look at the different kinds of hardening that need to occur on a physical level, there's different areas of the country and different geography that will drive different types of hardening, different types of weather. And so when we look at those kind of things, it's really important to make sure that it's not a one-size-fits-all approach to hardening. We don't want to say every single tower needs to be built to withstand a hurricane if that's not going to happen in that particular area. Also, there's a cost-benefit analysis that goes on based upon the amount of sites that you have and the kind of coverage that you have. You may have redundant backhaul in some cases or splitting the difference between fiber and microwave to make sure that you have some redundant capabilities and being able to backhaul that traffic. In other areas where you have a lot of sites, you might rely on multiple sites rather than building redundant backhaul into every site. And so you have to look at the big architecture and not just every single tower or location being treated the same way. And so for us, the whole hardening approach is something that is a very important element to public safety. We've reached out to our Public Safety Advisory Committee. We've reached out to a number of industry bodies and standards bodies and gotten a lot of advice on the kinds of things that they would like to see, just like I talked about now, and where that makes a big difference for them. Every day in America, there's a backhoe cutting fiber optic somewhere. And so how do we plan for that? And you can't plan for every single place that will happen, but you have to make the best amount of approach you can do within your cost model.
So your organization will create this public safety network within the financial parameters outlined in the Middle Class Tax Relief and Job Creation Act of 2012. But what is the funding mechanism for maintaining this network once it's deployed, and how does that ensure its sustainability?
Great question. I think the number one, our construction fund is a key element of getting us built with a lot of capital to make sure we get off on the right foot. But also having the ability to leverage our excess capacity is a way to help reach further regions of the nation, as well as to maintain that we have a sustainable network that has funding coming in to help with that maintenance and operations and gives us the ability to partner with those that have infrastructure that also needs to be maintained. If we look at even, you know, customer service or other elements where we might be able to leverage key things that exist today already, might help reduce the maintenance and operations cost. If there's ways to share backhaul or other facilities, there are things that would be synergistic to building a nationwide network. But most importantly, we need to make sure that if we have, you know, 95% of the capacity on a network available in some places during non-emergency times, that we leverage that part of the capacity to keep costs low for public safety, because our third source of funding is user fees. The Act requires that we have user fees for the sustainability of the network, but our goal is to keep those user fees as low as possible. And to be able to do that, we certainly need to leverage that excess capacity to keep those user fees low for public safety so that everybody in public safety gets access to this network.
And the user fee would be paid by the municipality? or?
Municipality or agency. So it could be a city, it could be a fire district, it could be an ambulance service, you know, whatever that happens to be.
Okay. So you're conducting, in your efforts, market research. And I want to understand, how has your research, previous RFP efforts, and overall outreach helped you refine your acquisition strategy and or business model, operating model? And how has it informed your acquisition goals?
So over the last year, FirstNet has conducted 12 requests for information, or RFIs, and that information has been very vital as we've looked at our market research to drive forward into our RFP in the future. One of the keys about requests for information is it allows all companies and players and anybody who has innovative ideas to bring them forward, and that's really allowed us to both meet with some of those companies and be able to really have a great dialogue about what the art of the possible is. We're now getting to a phase where that market research is coming to a head, so to speak, and that we've just released a significant request for information along with our draft statement of objectives. So that's helped drive that statement of objectives. And now we're looking for input from everyone on the statement of objectives as well as the very detailed questions that are in this request for information. That RFI and statement of objectives will help us drive into our draft RFP. And our market research will be coming to a close so that we can build that draft RFP and release that draft RFP. And it's really an important time for us because this gives industry a chance to really bring forward their very specific ideas that they want to make sure that FirstNet considers as we shape the RFP and bring that to a close.
So relative to your acquisition strategy, what is the purpose of the public notice period for FirstNet?
One of the things we want to make sure is that we're being very transparent and we're very open with all of our ideas, both about the request for information and the draft statement of objectives, as well as key interpretations and implementations of the Act. In the Act, there are a lot of details. It's not exactly a short Act, and so there's a lot of complexity. And one of the things we want to do is both explain the implementation of the Act and get feedback on some of our initial interpretations so that we make sure that we're getting all the feedback possible from everyone. We can receive feedback from public safety agencies. We might be receiving feedback from law firms that represent companies, from industry, from states, from tribal nations, from everybody who has a key play in how public safety is going to partake in FirstNet. And we really think the public notice is a great way for us to either put out an initial interpretation and implementation or just to ask for ideas before we even get to a preliminary implementation. And there's some of both in that public notice. And I think that's really important. As an example, if you think of a public safety user, one of the elements in the public notice is to help define that. In the Act itself, there's two definitions that we would use. So we talk about how to incorporate both of those definitions from previous acts. We talk about the definition of rural. One of the key elements in the Act is to have rural milestones. Very important if you look across the government today, there's a number of different definitions of rural. So we've talked about a specific definition and are asking for comment and feedback on that. And this is so that we can be really crystal clear as we move forward with our key stakeholders and also get all of their input before we implement those specificities.
Yeah. And, you know, I want to keep on the acquisition strategy because I think this is a very important part of your effort is getting this right. And so could you summarize for us your acquisition approach and tell us what parts of the recently announced, as you mentioned, public notice, comment period, RFI, draft statement of objectives, how do these elements play into realizing the vision of FirstNet?
I think for FirstNet, having a sustainable network is the key focus as we work through this year. And doing that, having the RFP really helps us lock down our costs. One of the things that a team like the team at FirstNet can do is estimate all the costs of what they think a network will cost. But as you get into an official acquisition, you actually get real bids and lock down what those costs are, and they become very solid. The second thing is, and it's unique to FirstNet, is because we do have the ability to leverage the excess capacity, is we also get to help lock down some of the revenue capabilities. And this will allow those people who will be bidding on that RFP to to also give us ideas in ways that are leveraging that excess capacity, which helps on the revenue side to really help build that sustainable network as we go forward. Also, there's more than one way to roll out an LTE network, and we've had a lot of different ideas posed to us, and now it's time for the rubber to meet the road as we move forward, both now with our RFI and draft statement of objectives, as well as with our draft RFP and then final RFP. It's for people to respond with ideas on how they would do both of those things, which will come up with a sustainable plan for FirstNet going forward.
So what are some of the key acquisition life cycle milestones that you can think of, and where in the timeline is the large comprehensive draft RFP issued?
So for us, there's a number of key timelines. We released this week with a 30-day time period, both the public notice and comment, and a 30-day response, which will come in around mid-October.
Okay.
Those mid-October responses for both the public notice and comment and the RFI and draft statement of objectives will then be analyzed over the next 30 to 60 days, which would bring us probably into December. Mm-hmm. That analysis of all those responses will really help us drive the draft RFP. In our strategic roadmap that we released last March, we had put out a timeline that our goal was to get a draft RFP out by March of 2015, and we're on track for that goal. And because of the focus on the strategic roadmap, I'm very proud to say that even getting this RFI and draft statement of objectives out shows you some of the key backbone that could end up in that draft RFP that will be first quarter of 2015 in that March timeframe. After that, based upon the response to the draft RFP, we'll have a final RFP. And often that can happen fairly quickly, but it's really hard to pin a date on that until we get those responses.
You've mentioned it a couple of times, the anecdote about going to, far reaches of Alaska and places where I was really astonished that 60% of the country is in the rural parts. So how have you figured out to engage these stakeholders in those areas and actually make it affordable for them?
It's a very unique problem. One of the things today is rural coverage is often defined by the economics. And a lot of the coverage that exists today is very, very good in urban areas. It's usually not too bad in suburban areas. And as you get to rural or frontier areas, it becomes much more difficult. We're looking at a number of possibilities on the best ways to address that. One is we want to, because of our unique structure and having the ability to leverage the excess capacity, the better job we do on leveraging the excess capacity, the deeper into those rural areas we can provide service. And that's an important element. If you look at the available extra capacity in a rural area, it's probably going to be higher than it is in an urban area. And so the better that we leverage that in a small community, so to speak, the better the service we can provide to that small community, because there's other things to help offset the cost of putting the cell sites in that particular area. And that's a very unique and different business model. Also, we're not ruling out elements such as satellite coverage where it makes sense. That's also an excellent tool for disaster recovery, even in urban and suburban areas, if you were to lose some terrestrial sites. We'll not necessarily have the same terrestrial LTE broadband speeds that you might have, but it's something that we're looking at. There's no decisions made on any of that, but it's certainly something that has continued to advance, and we want to make sure we look at the possibilities that are there. Lastly, we are leveraging deployable technologies and having the ability, if somebody were to go into a very, very remote area, that they could bring the network with them, and having a deployable capability that would be a system on wheels, so to speak. And we know that's not necessarily what we want to have in all rural areas, but it's a certain capability that would make sense in certain situations that may not be an area where a lot of activity occurs on a daily basis.
And so it wouldn't require such an investment, and this kind of helps that.
Correct. And also we have to look at, as part of our consultation effort, we want to make sure we work with states and territories to identify their priorities for coverage and that we're meeting those key priorities. A lot of the elements that you might see today in more remote parts of the country is there's a lot of coverage focus on roads, roads where people travel, roads where people have car accidents, things like that. And a lot of rural small towns and often are near those facilities, but we need to make sure that we coverage as much of that as possible and really reach out to the far rural areas of the country as much as we can.
What is FirstNet doing to use collaboration and partnership to meet its mission? We will ask TJ Kennedy, Acting General Manager of FirstNet, when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour.